Hello, Yes But Why listeners, this is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 217, in which I talk to Alex Marion and Nick Hildred of Release the Clowns podcast. But first, a bit about our sponsor. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. I just downloaded Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. It's a wild study on human behavior, and I'm loving it. You know, this and a lot of my podcast interviews are me talking to strangers, and my experience has always been positive. But that's not what the book is about. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Nick Hildred is a TV and radio writer and producer, as well as an improviser and sound editor. Alex Marion started his creative career by performing comedy and running comedy venues, then went to study improv with the Free Association, and that is where he met Nick. Together, Nick and Alex produce the Release the Clowns podcast. These two were a fun pair to talk to. In our conversation, Nick and Alex tell me about the separate adventures that eventually led them to find each other and start collaborating. Support Alex Marion and Nick Hildred by listening to Release the Clowns podcast, available on Podbean. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 217, Chaotic Comedy with Alex Marion and Nick Hildred of Release the Clowns podcast. Enjoy! Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
We got one, Alex.
I was just sort of thinking about that.
I could go first. I've got one.
Oh, you go ahead then.
I was about 12. We did a comedy play. I was the villain. And up to that point, I'd been in choirs, you know, singing church music and all that kind of thing. And I hated singing solo because my voice box would always close up from, I don't know, stage fright or whatever. But I ended up being in this play and finding that I could speak quite happily on stage. And really enjoyed it and enjoyed getting laughs and thought, this is brilliant. And then I put it in my back pocket for the next few years. And when I went to my senior school, the new boys like me, we were supposed to go and do the cadet force. It was either being in the scouts or the cadets. And I said to my mother, I don't want to do either of those because they're stupid. But they had a drama class that only boys who were already at the school could do. So I said to my parents, well, I won the drama cup for that play I was in at the previous school. Tell them that and I can get into drama. And they managed to wangle it. I could do drama.
Wow, and your parents helped. That's sweet.
Yeah, they did help. It was really cool. That drama club, which was every Monday, I did that for, I don't know, about 5 years at school. It was really cool. It was really nice. 3 hours every Monday. And it was basically learning improv and having fun, you know. So
3 hours
and
every Monday.
And then it went on from there.
I don't think I know any adults that are doing that kind of dedication. That's amazing. 3 hours every Monday. Yowza. I love it. For 5 years.
Yeah.
Man, what a class. God bless them. Tell me about the teacher of that drama club.
Well, the first one was a really great guy. He was he had a PhD, so he's Dr. Hansford. And he was just very laid back, really cool, and actually did it for, I think, 3 of the years. And he was just a very, actually very modern sort of improv teacher, in that very nurturing, very, you know, there aren't wrong things per se, but there are techniques you can use to make what you're doing better. If you know what I mean, you know, so not judgy. And that was really good. He created that very sort of welcoming and fostering atmosphere you get in good improv classes. So that was nice.
Yeah, that's nice. I wonder what he had his PhD in. Was it like early education? That's why he was giving you the nurturing parts of improv. I often think that that particular detail is about, you know, getting used to the fact that life is not really going to give you what you expect pretty much ever. So like when you learn the ability of improv to like kind of just go with the flow, it's like, okay, it's like my Zen life now.
Funnily enough, I think his PhD was in something to do with Samuel Beckett.
Nice. Nice. Awesome.
Yeah, he was very clever.
Mm. Something to do with Samuel Beckett.
That's what it says on the certificate.
Yeah.
That's awesome. What a great opportunity for you to have that drama club. And I'm so glad that your parents like supported you and got you in there for you to be able to do that for, you said 5 years, was that like pretty much until you went to university?
Yeah, Yeah, it was. I was in the drama club that whole time, managed to avoid having to dress up in any kind of uniform or go camping, which was bloody marvelous.
I like it. How I avoided going camping. Pretty good.
Yep.
Alex, what about you?
Well, weirdly enough, part of it's very similar, although there's no old captain, my captain moments in my story. I never liked the school play because I never liked auditioning because I was never one of those kids who was just so confident that they could go in and audition and blow it up. I'd be sort of mumbling on stage and then come off and then someone else would come on like 8 years old going, to be or not to be? Oh, for God's sake. I'm third tree on the right again, aren't I? So school play was awful for me. But I remember going to Scouts was one thing. And we used to do what was called a gang show, which is kind of like a review that the troupe does. And I remember hearing about that and thinking, right, that's mine. I'm taking this over. So I wrote it, I cast it, I performed it. It was all me. It was awful, but it was really good fun. And I thought, okay, so I can be in charge of everything. That's good, first thing.
Mm.
And I also remember about the same time, I used to go on camps in the summer down in the countryside, and we'd have at the end of the week, there'd always be like a little show around the fire. And I just remember finding out that I was good at making people laugh. And that was so much easier than school plays, because school plays, there was always serious bits in it. I don't really like that because I never really believed what I was saying. But if I could just go and mess around and be stupid and everyone laughs, that's great. So I remember I took that away with me. And then by my late teens, I'd started to discover stand-up. And I was just absolutely fixated on the idea of doing that, but absolutely terrified by doing it. So it took me several years, almost till the end of my university, in fact, to finally get around to actually doing it. But it was always fixed in my head from that point that I wanted to do something that was around making people laugh. Because surely it's just the best job in the world.
Surely. Yeah. I like it. I like that you were led into stand-up. It's very interesting to hear the way that, you know, you got into it. You know what I mean? It was like these gross, you know, boring school plays, as most of them are. And, you know, it's just not something you wanted to get into. Unfortunately, no doctor of Samuel Beckett to help you. So I like that you wrote and created that whole show. Are you kind of an organizer now? Like, are you the one who organizes, you know, your podcast stuff? Are you the one who's like producing shows and trying to get things going? Is that your vibe now?
I think that's sort of between both of us, isn't it, Nick?
Yeah, we're pretty much 50-50 on the on the podcast, it's I'd say about 50-50, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's nice. You never hear that.
I think certainly on the day of recording, it sort of tends to be, because you're in the studio, so it tends to be me having to sort of organise casting and making sure the sketches are set up and everyone knows what they're doing from time to time.
And Nick's on the technical stuff?
Yeah, so I run the studio have to do all the technicals.
Tough.
Because the thing is,
Alex.
There's what not allowed?
Because I'm not allowed. I'm not allowed to touch anything.
Oh, geez, no, no. Alex isn't allowed to touch any electrical equipment.
I have this sort of reverse superpower where any not just electrical equipment, anything that's standing up, if I touch it, it will fall down.
Me too. Me too. I get the same electrical thing. God, I need to send you a photo of the room that I'm in. It's like I'm in, my husband is an AV tech. Thank God he knows everything. I know nothing. If he didn't press the buttons, like 30 seconds before I got on the Zoom, I was like, babe, the buttons, they're not working the way they're supposed to. Like, that's me. So I feel you, brother. And also to Nick, the tech wizard. So I appreciate you as well, because without you, it wouldn't sound as nice. I was going to compliment you guys on the smoothness of your podcast, that it sounded very well edited and put together. So good job.
Oh, thank you. That's all Nick, Mr. Audio Magic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good. Smooth.
Yeah. The funny thing is, of course, is I spent most of my career not being technical at all. I just kind of fell into doing technical stuff.
I want to hear more about how Nick fell into the technical side.
All right, yeah.
Let's go back to the story again.
We're all right.
Oh,
it's okay. You had Mr. Holland's Opus, and then we had Alex talk to, is about to do stand up, but we'll come back to you after are you performing at university? How did you get into technical stuff, or what were you doing previous to your developing your technical acumen?
Okay, well, a very potted history. At university, I joined the comedy club, which was not the best comedy club in the world, it's got to be said. It was called the Pig Fondlers Guild. Pig Fondlers Comedy Guild. And they were very, I thought they were a bit too amateurish for my liking. Some of them would just get drunk before going on stage. I literally drunk and then stumble their way through sketches, and it was excruciating. But their mates found it funny. So, sure. I know three or four other guys joined at about the same time that all had the same kind of thing of, we actually want to do this stuff and go to Edinburgh and be good. So we got it on a much more sort of proper footing and did halfway decent shows and a couple of runs in Edinburgh, the usual sort of thing.
I've never been to Edinburgh, so it's not quite usual for me. I don't know. Also, I was going to ask, is the idea of going to that festival kind of like part of, like, when you're in college doing theater stuff, is that like kind of one of the things you guys consider as like a, if we're doing well, we could bring it to the festival? Or are there multiple things like that where you're like, there's four festivals per year and everybody goes to all of them? What's the, when you're in school and you're like working on stuff, it's just that. Interesting. Awesome. Good for them.
Yeah, because we were doing sketch comedy at university. And there's really only the one outlet for that kind of thing, and that's the Edinburgh Fringe.
Huh.
Because everyone wants to become the next Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, or the next Monty Python team, or the next, Emma Thompson. I didn't want to be the next Emma Thompson. I want to make that very clear.
I would love to be the next Dudley Moore. So, I mean, I really appreciate the references that you get who I know. So,
oh yeah,
but it's super interesting, the idea for me, like that Edinburgh is always like a possibility where you guys are like working towards it, like on the regular. Like, that's pretty great. Like, I don't think I ever submitted to a festival until I was in my 30s. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't think that any of the things I was doing were like good enough to, I don't know, show people, I guess. I mean, I did lots of plays and lots of different stuff, but yeah, I don't know. The idea of that
thing is,
it's just wild.
Don't get the impression that any of it was good enough.
I mean, but you did it, right?
No, that would be laboring under a false apprehension. Edinburgh probably wasn't good enough.
Yeah, but it's like an option.
Yeah, I mean, we got our review. Oh, we got some terrible reviews. I think one of them was, it's hard enough to do sketch comedy when the audience is outnumbered by the actors. And then it went on with something like, but this unadulterated pile of dog was never going to get a laugh. So that was one of our reviews.
I like that you've memorized it. Do you have it tattooed on your arm?
No. The funny thing is, though, similar to that thing of the Amy Poehler, except not nearly as good, is I after doing that and being at university and then getting jobs in TV, I met a number of people who were at Edinburgh at the same time as me, who I knew were in other reviews and or other shows. And they were saying that some of their reviews were just as bad, you know. And these are guys who are, you know, paid TV comedy writers who got reviews like, lobotomized sea sponges could have done this better.
That's just a writer who's jealous they didn't get into the festival. Like, if you get a review that's that well written, that's just jealousy. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
hate with minimal artistry to your writing is all I'm saying. Keep it simple. So you worked in television after college. What kind of television jobs? What did you get a degree in?
I got a degree in philosophy.
Makes sense.
Which qualifies me for nothing. And then I went into radio writing. Well, I went into radio writing first,
of course.
Comedy. Mm-hmm. And then was very lucky, and then went into TV for a few years.
What is radio writing? Like,
well,
are you writing ads?
Writing shows, comedy shows, you know.
Oh.
So writing the scripts for...
Oh, for radio, for like an... Oh, okay. I'm thinking like, you know, a guy's on the radio going like, hey guys, I'm going to play this next thing. And I was like, I'm pretty sure they don't write a script for that guy. But
No.
I
this
get
is
it.
Actual
totally.
Sketches.
Right.
Yeah. It wasn't just any sketch show either, was it?
Oh.
Well, Weekending.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It was Weekending on Radio 4.
Oh.
Which means nothing to... Pretty much nothing to anybody these days, but it was a long-running satirical radio show that had been going for 25 years. I mean, you know,
that's a
on
big
BBC
deal.
Radio. So.
Thank you, Alex. Don't just call yourself
good.
Nick.
Sorry, Alex?
It was something of an institution.
Mm.
It was, yes.
See, that's nice.
Well,
you're
mean,
right.
Everyone was crazy in it. Yeah.
But that's fun. Like, it's amazing that you got that gig right out of school. Like, you're working, you're writing sketches. Somebody must have seen you and thought it wasn't so terrible, right? And they gave you that job. So you're writing sketches. And are you performing them or are other people performing them?
No, other people were performing them.
Great. So, even better. Way low stakes, in my opinion. When other people are saying it, I'm like, oh, yeah, whatever. Here, take the script.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's kind of a rite of passage for a lot of comedy writers, or it was.
Oh, yeah.
Until they axed the show. So yeah, it was all very good, and So I did that for a while. And so
you're with a lot of people that were working in that kind of scene. If it was a rite of passage, then there's a lot of people that are going through that thing. I also find it awesome that other people who got bad reviews at Edinburgh got the jobs with you in television. And it was like, you know, there was one guy who was just like, find everybody with the worst reviews and hire them. Why? Because they're actually good. The reviewers are mad. and they're like, maybe that's sweet. The case. Yeah. I mean, review, you know.
Yeah.
But so what's the TV thing? So you, after doing Weekending, which was a big deal. Thank you, Alex, for letting me know. It's, you know, you're working in TV. Are you writing in TV, writing comedy in TV?
Yeah. So I just went on to write various, entertainment shows. This is sort of one of those regrets. You think, oh, if only I'd got a sitcom, but you know, you can't go back to that. So I wrote various entertainment shows. You know, gags for the presenters and that kind of thing. Basically, think crap TV. I wrote a bunch of that. I'm not proud of it.
I feel like perhaps our definitions of crap TV are different potentially. And also like you underestimate the level of like terrible choices I have available to me every day where I'm like, yeah, I could watch this guy literally dig this one hole for 45 minutes. This is a riveting show. So, you know, there's a lot of things out there. Don't sell yourself short. You're writing comedy. It's on Hulu. It's available. I'll see. Maybe it's just a US show, you know, so we feel good about ourselves. God, that guy dug a hole. He really did something. What's an entertainment show? Like meaning like there's a celebrity host who's interviewing other celebrities and they like, you're the one who writes that they get like do a slip and slide. Like, are you the guy who makes
the big one was The Big Breakfast, wasn't it? Which was sort of like a morning TV magazine show on crack.
Yeah, that's actually very, it was, a lot of it was on crack. It has to be said.
Oh, okay.
Late
80s, early 90s, or?
late 90s, early noughties.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Makes sense, cool.
Yeah, so, it was great stuff.
I
wish I'd done the drugs that everyone else seemed to be doing because they seemed to enjoy it a lot more than I did. But you know, it was good. It was a great thing to be doing. That was a good show. Actually, that had high production values. You know, it was the kind of show where we're going to have a chicken on the show, a four-legged chicken.
Okay.
So can you imagine this? They found a chicken with four legs that thought it was a dog and would follow vocal commands from its owner. And they were very excited. They were like building the entire 2-hour show around this chicken. And then at about 4:30 in the afternoon before that program was due to go out, one of the producers went to the executive producer and said, "We got a problem with the chicken." They said, "What?" "It's died today." The chicken has died. And with barely half a second, the executive producer just said, "Stuff it. Get it stuffed. Get it on the show. I want that fucking chicken on the show tomorrow morning. Phone up a taxidermist." So that's what they did. They had it taxidermied and brought on the show.
Oh my God. I really didn't think it was going to actually happen. I thought it would just be like, but it turns out taxidermy takes multiple weeks. So, oh my God. Imagine. Okay. I'm sorry. All I can think right now is about that taxidermist who got the phone call. Who's like, "I'm sorry, what?" "But I mean, I don't usually do that rush of a job. How much are you going to pay me?" "Oh yeah. I mean, I can do it. Where do I need to pick it up?" "Yep, no problem. I got this." Like, I love the idea of that. Like, oh my God, that's great. Isn't it funny how like the best stories are like when everything went terribly wrong? Like, it was not fun at the time. You're always, and I try so hard. Whenever I'm having the worst time, there's a voice in the back that goes like, you'll tell this and it'll be funny. Don't worry. I'm like, okay, hold on to that. Hold on to it hard. I mean, I'm literally doing that now. I said that like today. I was like, man, in 5 years, I can't wait to talk about this. Like, I don't want to talk about it now. But in the future, when we are like laying on soft couches and everyone's super safe and healthy, I'm gonna be like, guys, remember? Crazy. Like, and that's the fun times, right?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, it's true. It does have its moments, but not at the time. At the time, it's excruciating and painful.
Oh, Nick, I'm so sorry. You seem to have had a rough time.
No, not at all. No. Oh. That wasn't doing that show. Doing the Big Breakfast was like being in an abusive relationship. The senior executives were constantly abusing people and shouting at you. And I once had the senior editor come in and swear at me, literally for about 1.5 straight minutes of just swearing. And since we're not doing profanities, I can't even say what his first sentence was. But let's see. Nick, the third word was an F word, and it got worse from there.
Did you know specifically what he was yelling about? Was it like, I messed this up, or, oh, I feel like he didn't like my copy. Like, was it a clear thing, or is it like one of those bosses where like they come in at any moment and they're screaming at you? And while, yes, you're feeling it, you're also thinking like, what could this be about?
Oh, no, I was in no doubt. What had happened was the producer I was working with, kept misinterpreting what the executive wanted. So the executive would say to him, to the producer, I want X. And then the producer would come into me and say, Ben wants Y. So I'd write Y and send it to Ben, who'd then call the producer in and say, listen, I said I wanted X and I've got Y. Could you get me X? And the producer would come back to me and say, Ben wants Z. So I'd write Z. And once we'd done that about 3 times, Ben went completely mental and came into the room and just, like I say, swore at me. And after he'd finished swearing, it's one of the few times in my life I've actually come up with a quip at that point. So he finished swearing and I said, do you want me to rewrite it then? And he said, yes, I bloody do. And the thing is, he told me what he wanted, so I wrote it, and he said, yeah, that's fine. But the producer was in the room as well, and he stood there and let me just take it without intervening once to say, oh, actually, I think I got that wrong.
Sounds like
that wasn't it.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Yeah, it was actually. I wouldn't have put my head above the parapet either.
No.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's like, come on, let's be honest. So that's every me. One of us in that situation would have been like, oh, yeah, I'm not directing that wrath my way. I'm just going to hang right here.
No.
See what happens.
Yes.
If he turns it to me, I'll take it, but I'm going to wait. Wait.
So man. That's my story.
Yeah. Rough stories. Yowza. Did you work
Alex.
In other television shows after The Big Breakfast, or did that sort of burn you from the scene?
No. I did a bunch of other shows, but when my daughter was born in 2007, I gave up TV completely.
Why? Just too many crazy hours?
Too many crazy hours. Also, almost everyone I know who works in TV is divorced.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I really like my wife.
Oh, that's nice.
And I think she quite likes me too.
Oh, that was going to be my line.
Oh,
oh, sorry, sorry, Alex. So I gave up TV. I couldn't take any more. The hours.
Yeah.
You know, so
the hours, the stress, the yelling. Yeah, I hear that. The drugs, even if you're not taking them, they affect you. Oh man, because that's a real thing. I mean, wow.
No, good God, for you. Yeah. No, I I can't even. Anyway, yes. Yeah, so I'm much happier now. I'm doing this than I ever was writing TV. You know, so.
Sure, it's and like I'll tell your you for why. Thing.
It's like Alex was saying. It's like Alex was saying when he did his review, his review with the Scouts, and he was in charge. With this, we're in charge, so we can create the atmosphere that we want for our co-conspirators, and it's a happy ship, and we can do things the way we want to do it. You know, I think it's a happy ship, unless you're about to tell me something like get stuffed, Alex.
After the break, this bombshell. No.
Yeah, this is a gotcha podcast for sure.
No, so I'm absolutely on board with that, Nick. It is. It's us doing what we want to do with people that we like, which is, broadly speaking, unlike any other job I've had.
The collaboration you are directly talking about right now is the Release the Clowns podcast, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Just making sure neither of you have said it. So I just was like, hey, man.
Yeah.
Hey, man, maybe they do a lot of things together. Because, hey, you know, that's how that works out. So let's jump back to Alex. Not only do I have I know there's a sweet Edinburgh story ready to come in, but we have just begun to explore Alex's stand-up career. How did that go? Did you have, like, friends who told you you were funny?
So basically, I didn't get involved in the Comedy Society at university because there wasn't one at our university. What there was the Theatre Society, which was full of... Do you remember I talked about the people at auditions who I had when I was at school? It was all of them. All of the biggest show-offs you can imagine. And I just wasn't interested. So I basically spent my university years... drinking and watching comedy, but not doing it. Right up until the end, when there was we decided to do a sketch show, which was great fun. Really, sort of rekindled my enjoyment in doing comedy and being on stage, making people laugh. So a few of us decided we were going to do our own group. So we set up this night down the road from the university. And we just sort of threw everything into it. We were going to do sketch. We were going to do improv. I was going to compare it. So I thought I should probably learn how to do stand-up on stage. So I finally bit the bullet and went and did some stand-up gigs, which was terrifying. So bear in mind, I'd wanted to do stand-up since I was about 14 or 15, and at this point I was 25. And I booked myself a gig. You had to book it like weeks, a couple of months in advance. And it wasn't until I was on the train on the way to the gig that I thought I should probably actually write something. So I sat on the train and wrote this routine, which I thought was going to be about 10 minutes, but actually lasted about four, of the most gut-wrenching terror. And people laughed at bits of it. And I thought, yeah, I can do that. So I carried on. Unfortunately, not long after that, I started teaching and I was broke. So teaching paid the rent. So that had to take most of my attention. And really what happened over the next decade or so was that I start doing stand-up. Get just to the sort of fringes of moderately successful and then drop out of it because teaching took over again. And I never really wanted to be, I was a bit conflicted about the whole fame thing as well. I never really wanted to be famous. So I was always careful never to be good enough.
Oh yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's a strategy, Nick. It works.
Mm-hmm. It's very considerate of you, Alex.
It's very considerate of me. And so just sort of started, I was doing it, then I wasn't doing it, then I got distracted by things. So I went traveling around the world for a couple of years, and then me and my wife started running rave nights, and that was another big distraction that came in. It was great fun, but it didn't really doing teaching all day, doing raves all weekend, and then trying to do comedy at night didn't really fit together that well.
And did you like produce a dance
with
club?
The hours, Nick. Yeah.
So, like, tell me about these rave nights. Tell me what that means. You and your wife are like, hey, you know what would be cool? 400 people dancing in a room. Cool. We don't have a room that big. How do we do it? How do you do it?
Well, how we did it was we went to a place that we knew that we'd been raving at up in North London, which was, it was called Trends. It was in Stoke Newington, and it was an old club that had actually been owned by the Cray Twins, who are very famous London gangsters. Hmm. And still had a lot of the old fittings, like velvet seats and mirrored ballrooms and all this sort of stuff. And it was run by this this yardie guy called Danny, who charged us rent and put security on, and it was all good. It turns out in the end that Danny didn't actually own it. I don't know exactly what happened, but at some point, which I think was when the last of the Cray brothers died, the estate must have come in and turfed him out. It turned out he'd been squatting it for 20 years while they were in prison.
Oh.
In prison and or dead.
And or.
So, yeah, that's basically what we did. We paid money to a person who didn't own a place to do a thing in a place for a while and then stopped.
You know what's crazy? I feel like I also have done those things. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like 3/4 of the theaters, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes here, that I rented to do plays throughout my life were like definitely some scam of some kind, or like I paid for some sort of terrible drug ring or whatever. Like, there was always just like, I'm just two shades of Pollyanna where I'm all like, he's fine. He seems very nice. And people are like, are you really sure? You should, that guy. And I'm like, you guys are being jerks. Like, you're being, no, he is fine. Oh man. I think about the plays that we did where it was like, why can't we get this construction debris out of this room? Oh, okay. So we just have to put a fake wall up in front of it and make that the theater. Okay, that's fine. Like, or, you know, why doesn't the door lock? Should we bring our props home with us? Yes, we should. Okay. So, I mean, crazy things. I love the fact that, like, it turns out that you were doing a rave on the regs in, like, a, you know, mobster's club, unbeknownst to, you know, this situation. Like, oh, man, that's a sweet movie right there. I like that. That's super awesome. Well, that's so fun.
Funnily enough, that theme is going to come back.
So
basically, as Nick said, like the hours get you in the end. Like teaching all day and then I was driving up and down the country going to gigs all over the place. And it was great fun, but I was knackered. And I just got to a point where I'd stopped and I didn't start again. And then some friends of mine put to me the idea of going up to Edinburgh. So as I said earlier, at this point, there's you can do free shows. So basically people don't pay to go in, and on the way out, you wave a bucket at them, and if they liked it, they put money in. And that keeps things really cheap for the artist because they're not paying huge rent for the room and they're not doing whole ticket splits and all of this sort of stuff. So me and some friends who'd been around the Free Fringe for a while said, well, why don't we try and give it a go? Well, no, actually, that's not exactly what happened. What happened was they wrote a letter, or we wrote a letter to the guy who runs one of the main Free Fringes up there, suggesting some changes. And he, being an absolute nutcase, went public saying that he'd been stabbed in the back and betrayed and he wouldn't work with these people ever again. So we thought, and he said, if you think it's so easy doing this, why not do it yourself? So we thought we will.
Oh.
So we went up and we got agreements with loads of rooms. One of which was a huge room in the center of town, or a huge building in the center of town, that we split up into loads of rooms, which is run by gangsters. Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of what happens at the Fringe is run by gangsters, I now know.
Ooh, well.
So we did it for and 1 year. Pardon me?
And the Masons.
And the Masons, indeed. Didn't fall foul of those, though. So we had all of these rooms. We got all of our acts in. This is 2014. We had a great year, full rooms, lots of really good reviews, some awards, all sorts of stuff. And we're thinking, oh, we're really good at this. We should do it again. So we went back the next year to do it. We hadn't spotted the biggest hole, which was that we'd got a sponsor, and the sponsor, even in the first year, even before we'd started, was already screwing us. Basically not fulfilling any of the promises that they'd made. I'm not going to say who the sponsor is.
Don't.
Anyone who's in Edinburgh at all, all I'll say is it's a well-known Edinburgh-based pizza chain. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say any more than that. It's a well-known Edinburgh-based pizza chain that runs stalls.
Uh-oh.
I'm not going to say that it's the ones by the Tron Kirk, but that's who it was. So we went back for the second year, and even before we started doing this, it was clear that the sponsors were going to screw us even harder and even longer and even deeper than they had the previous year. But we still kept going with it. And we booked out. So my job was booking the acts. So I got hundreds of videos and applications and everything, and I watched every single one. I read every single word. I put together a great bill. The guy who was supposed to be sorting out the rooms assured me that they were. What I now realize is, he is still a friend of mine, by the way, so I'm
just don't tell him about the podcast. It's fine. You just don't tell him
about it. He was having a manic episode. And he hadn't secured the rooms at all. The gangsters who he hadn't secured them with, he then made a phone call to say, well, if you're not going to do what we want you to do, we're going to pull out and we'll go somewhere else. And he said, well, actually, I'll go somewhere else. And he went to the nutcase who kicked them out in the first place and said, do you want this room? He jumps in and did it. And we went in one overnight, in one night, we went from being about 20 grand in profit to about 20 grand in debt.
Wow.
And had to keep going. So I spent the next 2 months setting up a new venue. Me and the rest of us setting up a new venue, which the sponsors set up for us, promised to help pay for, and then didn't. And also redistributing all of our acts who'd paid to be in this one big building to other promoters or to other rooms that we had. Finally got to Edinburgh, we were just desperately trying to tread water here. Turns out that the new venue that we had, which was an old set of railway arches, well, not railway arches, but arches, it was in a complete shambolic state. We had to go in and do all of that up. Nobody knew where it was, even though it was in the center of town. Nobody could see it. Google Maps had it on the wrong street. It turns out lots of people were turning up to the street above ours. If you know Edinburgh at all, it's on levels. People were turning up to the street above ours, but not coming into ours. We were desperately trying to get people in as much as we possibly could. We finally managed to have on the second Saturday night of the festival, we had a really full crowd. We did a party. We had loads of people down there. Seemed to be turning the corner. 4 o'clock the next morning, we had a phone call from the sponsor saying, I don't want to alarm you, but we've just had a report that there's a fire down at the arches. And it turns out what had happened was someone had gone in, switched on all the stuff. I think they'd broken in with some girls. Two guys had broken in with some girls and tried to impress them by switching everything on and showing that they were in charge of this place. And then a fire had started and they'd run away. So we now had to pay for that fire. We had to pay for the fire damage.
Wow.
We had to pay for the damage to the bar, who were also screwing us because they never gave us any money. And then right at the end of it, everyone else buggered off to Turkey, and I had to stay there on this site desperately trying to shift all the equipment and chairs we had there to try and get the money back in. So it's not so much a great story as a deep trauma, but thank you very much.
No, I think it's a very important story, both for you and for, you know, the listeners to hear. It's something that actually happens. Also, the idea of all the stuff that you were responsible for is important to recognize. I know tons, thousands, millions even, of people out there producing shows with no knowledge of, like, you know, insurance or sponsorship or what happens when this goes down or what happens when you have to switch something. Like, just the fact that anything happened at all is amazing. Like you guys could have just been like, nope, and walked away after, like, the gangsters were like, we sold the place to another people. Like, there's just, you know, there were so many times in that story when it went terribly wrong. And it seems that you
bear in mind that's just the edited highlights.
Right.
Well.
Yeah. Plus, that's not even experiencing it. That's like a sweet 5-minute version story of it, right? Like, as opposed to like, no, this was months of my life, like, ripped apart. I get it. And the fact that you kept at it, that you were like, I'm making this happen, that's admirable, right? You could have quit at any point, but you didn't, right? You kept trying to make it happen. You kept trying to honor your commitments. You kept trying to put this show together. That matters. That's a good story. And that in and of itself is a good thing, like a quality to have when you're a person who wants to do, you know, this kind of stuff. You want to work in comedy? You want to produce shows? Great. Well, this is stuff that happens. So can you handle that? If you can't, then it's really nice working at the grocery store. Like, you know what I mean? Like, go ahead. You know, it's an honorable job. I'm just saying, like, you don't have to worry about producing a whole thing if you don't have to worry about it, right? But what's funny in your story, Alex, and you know, similarly in the terrible stories of Nick as well, is that you kept good doing it, right? Like what you wanted out of comedy was still there. Yeah. No, you're trying to find something. We all are. That's why I keep doing stuff. Like I, you know,
compelled to, like those stupid drumming monkeys.
Yeah, absolutely. But in a good way, in a fun way, you know, like, you can't stop being who you are. You can't stop wanting what you want. I would like to do comedy. It seems, let's try it this way. Every single roadblock available was put in front of me. Maybe this isn't my path. Let's try another one, right? And that, honest to goodness, really and truly is what I'm always trying to communicate with this podcast, for real, is that, like, you might have to reinvent yourself and do different things. And also, you might find that the lifestyle required of one of these jobs that you thought you wanted isn't the lifestyle you want to live. Like, we're all different. Some people like it, you know, like staying up late and stuff like that. Like when I heard that SNL didn't have to do the overnight thing, but that they do it because it's cool, I was like, get the hell out of here. Like they could work 9 to 5 and just go to bed like normal people, but they don't, right? That's their choice. That's what they want to do. That's the lifestyle they want to live. In the same way that, like, building a festival like Edinburgh requires, like, a nose to the grindstone insanity, negotiation with 1,000 people who have a likelihood of taking advantage of the situation, and, you know, you're trying to do art and they're just trying to do business and they don't care who you are, you know, like, but that's real. That's real life. If you're not famous and somebody's not going, like, you want to work for this program, you're boots on the ground asking a person, I notice you have this open space, can I rent it? Like, and that guy's good or bad, and you deal with that. Like, I don't know, it's real. It's like, you keep trying to do it, and clearly you're such a producer. Alex, rave nights? Like, the effort of all of these things is so intense. Like, I don't know. When I listen to people's stories, I glean things and I put together a full story, but I'm not living it. What do you think? Like, is it like you keep doing it because you love it, or, you know, are you Sisyphus up the hill or whatever?
You keep doing it because you love it. Once things start to go wrong, to begin with, you keep doing it because you're convinced you can make it right. In the end, you keep doing it because you can't stop, because there are too many other people relying on you.
Mm.
So you have to keep going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the honorable thing to do, to continue to honor your commitments. You were like, I said I would do this, and even if it doesn't work out the way I wanted it, I'm doing it. It's happening. Man, there's a lot of that. Go ahead.
That was one of the things that I thought, ooh, I reckon Alex would be a really good person to do a podcast with. Because I used to do a podcast back in 2005. I did a podcast called Whack My Bush, which was a satirical podcast about George Bush Jr., and Tony Blair and John Prescott, it was a satirical show. And my co-producer of that, sadly, died after various years and things. And it must have taken me at least 7 years to find a new creative partner, which is Alex. Alex, you're my new creative partner.
Am I?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Bad news. Yeah, but seriously, it's really difficult when your creative partner dies, because you're sort of lost, especially if you've been doing, me and my creative partner, it was a guy called Ed Rickard Bell. We did, three different podcast series, which were all perfectly successful, good listenership, et cetera, et cetera. And then he had a brain tumor and he passed away. And it's difficult to find someone that you can rely on creatively and in a sort of organizational way too. So yeah, Alex, you've got something to say on this as well.
Well, yeah, I think you said it. I think it really is those two things. You've got to be you've got to get each other creatively. You've got to want to do the same things, but you've also got to know that you can rely on each other to get jobs done. I've had lots of things that I started off with people and it became really quickly apparent that they weren't interested in doing any of the hard work, and it all sort of ends up falling on you. Which is just not fun at all. I mean, I had one sketch group that I was part of, where it started off, we were going to write together, we were going to perform together, we were going to book gigs together. It ended up that I was writing all of the sketches. I was booking all of the gigs. We also agreed to set up a night so we could have a place where we'd definitely be able to perform regularly. And I ended up having to do all of the work on booking, setting up the room and promoting it. And at some point I just turned around to them and said, look, I'm not doing this anymore, because you're clearly not that interested in doing any work. And I think that happens quite often. Whereas with Released Clowns.
I said, that's really selfish, man. Sorry.
But to answer a question you asked quite a while ago, Amy, I'm not a natural organizer. I don't think anyone who goes into comedy is a natural organizer.
No, I don't know.
It's funny, because I went into comedy for the organization.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
well,
what the reviews of your sketch show said. It wasn't funny, but it was really well organized.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I've gotten that review. I think there's two different kinds. Well, probably there's about 40 different kinds of comedians out there. But like in my experience, I find that there's people that want to do all the work and all the parts and all the organizing. And then there's the people who want to just show up and have it happen around them. And I wish I didn't have to work with the people who wanted to show up and have it happen around them, but I do. So I often have a group of two or three people where we're kind of like the leaders of the group, and we take most of the responsibility. And then we just give, small bits to the people who we have know aren't going to do the other parts. Like I've given up trying to like change people or try to make them work when I know they're not going to work. So instead I just take note of who works and who doesn't. And then I've put people into where they want to be. Like I can't fight with that. And it's not like comedy's not where I think to the point of comedy isn't really where you find a bunch of organizers. I think it's like comedy is not where you're gonna do well being like, guys, we've got to play by the rules. What are you doing? There's not a lot of that that goes well. You know what I mean? So you have to find a way of getting what you want out of the situation without nagging about it. And I nagged for years. Oh my God, I nagged for years. And then I had a bunch of people come to me and be like, Amy, you really can't do this anymore. So now I just wait and watch. And then whatever that person provides, I take. And, if I give them five jobs and they do two jobs, I have a backup for the three jobs they don't do. But I usually also work with people where I know more about the way they work, or I have somebody that I know that works with them. So I can be like, how are they with learning lines? Like, oh, they don't learn lines, but the audience loves them. And you're like, cool. What about showing up for rehearsal? Do they do it? Yes. 20 minutes late. Excellent. I'll put their stuff at the end of the rehearsal. Like you can't like I've stopped trying to make people arrive on time or do the work that they need to do. I give them just enough and then they do that. Right. So I don't know. I would consider myself a producer and an organizer. I see that that Alex, you don't feel that way. You do a lot of producing just from the stories I have been told. Just throwing that out there. This seems to be a skill set you have, in case you were unaware. But I get not wanting to do it. Oh boy, howdy do I. I too have taken a break from producing shows since I had my child in 2017. So I've been sort of stay-at-home momming for the past 3 years. So I haven't been producing shows in theaters anymore and going out and doing that. I still teach classes, but mostly online or, like a weekend level one improv here and there. It's not the same kind of thing. I'm not like every week.
Already.
What's up?
You were already set up for lockdown then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lockdown is pretty much just like the rest of the world learned what I'd been doing. No, like not even a joke. Like everyone's like, oh, my God, how am I going to sit inside all the time? I was like, yeah, I got over that hump after the first year.
For me, lockdown has been a nightmare because I work from home normally. Normally, it's me and the dogs and nobody else. And since lockdown, it's been me, the dogs, my wife, my daughter, and my mother-in-law. Oh. All in the same house. And I've still got to do the same thing. I still haven't written a sitcom, yeah.
I mean, you don't have to write it. You just have to put cameras up and then just put the transcript of the videos into an AI. And then there you go. You get your script. There it is.
Writes itself.
My terrible life. And that's what it's called. Done. Pitch it to anyone.
That sounds like it's the name of a show already.
It does, doesn't it?
My terrible life? Probably. And it's probably like, I live in a mansion. I don't have enough diamonds. You guys. Like, that's what it is. I was like, don't get it twisted. It's not about actual terrible lives. That's just real life. Oh my God. So let's get to you guys Release the Clowns podcast. You guys didn't know each other during these amazing journeys that you've shared with me, all these things that you've learned, all this like comedy that you've been doing, but separately. How did you meet? Tell me about that kismet moment.
So basically, after the Edinburgh debacle, I went through about a year when I did not want to go out of the house, meet anyone, do anything. I was genuinely just decided to lock myself away. Mm-hmm. And then my wife, who I rather like, I just thought I'd get that in there.
Good. It's good, helpful.
She spotted these improv classes and said, well, why don't you go and do that? Just go and do something to get yourself out again. And I started going and really enjoyed it. And that's where I met Nick.
Oh, yeah. Where was it?
North London. Yeah, North London.
That's the sort of Austin of London.
Okay. Like a theater or like a group? What's the crowd? Who'd you take the class with?
It's a group called the Free Association. Mm. We're sort of a collective of improvisers.
Yeah.
I like it.
And I had started doing improv, I think it was 2 years previously, and had done the level one course and then a level two course with a completely different group called Monkey Toast, and then stopped for a year and then did the level two course again. And I think the level three course. And at the end of that, you do a show and it was all great. And you know what it's like if you're in improv class, everyone's like, we're going to be the best friends forever.
Yep.
And what happened was I everyone else signed up for the next level class. And I realized it was clashing with, I was on holiday for a week for one of them. And then two of them I couldn't do for various family reasons. And I said to the teacher, well, I can't do three of the 10 classes. Is that a problem? He said, you can't do the class. I went, oh, okay. But I really wanted to do another improv thing. So I found the Free Association, signed up to their class. And the first night, the first class, my first sketch was, I think, with Alex, mm-hmm. Mending a Broken TV.
Oh, I love that you remember it.
Yeah.
It was a fun little sketch, wasn't it?
It was brilliant. It was one of those things. It just worked. It worked really nicely.
So the only direction we had was that we're fixing a TV, and we sort of built this scene where it became apparent that I was having an affair with Nick's wife.
Yeah.
In Nick's scene wife, by the way, I should clarify that.
Sure.
And it was just really good fun.
Yeah, it was. It was really good fun. And, it's kind of like, in some respects, it is like meeting a romantic partner.
Totally.
You know, normally within the first, I don't know, 10 minutes or so, whether you're going to get on or not.
Yeah.
You know, there's a chemistry there.
You know, it's funny. I think you're right that it actually is like that. And I think that a lot of times that's what people like misunderstand, that the feeling can represent different things. You know what I mean? Because I definitely have. I call this one guy that I work with, Patrick, I call him my work boyfriend. Like, because, and my husband calls him my work boyfriend, right? Because like we are together on stuff. Like when we make stuff, it's awesome. We love it working together, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah. it's like I didn't, you know, if I were, I don't know, younger, I guess, I would potentially be like, oh no, but what if I like Patrick? Does that hurt my marriage? It doesn't hurt my marriage. Who cares? Like, I'm not trying to date Patrick, right? I'm just trying to make stuff. And he also wants to make stuff. And we like making the same kind of stuff. Cool, right? Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing.
Well, that's one of the good things about getting older.
Yeah.
To be honest, is that, you know, we work with a number of really talented women who, you know, you really connect with in a scene. Yeah. And I don't know about you, Alex. I mean, I just get on with the women we have in Release the Clowns so wonderfully well.
Yeah.
I know the other side of being a male-female relationship doesn't even occur. It's just really lovely having that connection is just brilliant.
Yeah. You know, I often thought about it when I got married. It was like I was released from the burden of having to try to date. Like I was released, like I could look at everyone like a human again. I wasn't just like, who wants to do it? Like, it was just like,
instead of... Was that your move?
Yeah, of course.
Just walk into a room, who wants to do it?
Oh, not out loud, under my breath.
Are you sure? Are you sure?
I mean, I go up to small groups, not like the whole room at once.
Replay some of those situations in your head. Are you sure?
No. But then when I got married, I was released from that. I didn't have to worry about that. Who cares? I'm not doing it with anybody, right? So I was like able to make friends again and like really talk to people. And it wasn't like, do I have a crush on this person? What's going on? Like, are we like friends or are we like dating? And I don't know why. It's just like a weird, gross drug that is in yourself for until you're finally, your body says to you, this one, we're going to stick with this one. So you can just stop worrying about all that crap. And then it went away. And I was like, look at I have guy friends again. Like, honestly, for years, I'd stopped having guy friends in high school. I only hung out with guys because I wasn't doing anything in high school. I was just being a person, right? And then I started dating in college, and all of a sudden, I couldn't have guy friends, and I didn't know why. It was because I wanted to do it. I kept saying, hey, do you want to do it? It was very uncomfortable. I shouldn't have done it.
Yeah, I'm spotting a pattern here, Amy.
It's my problem, really. It's my problem. But let's talk more about your love and how it developed and blossomed into this beautiful podcast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
Alex.
Wow.
You can take this one, Nick.
Oh, okay.
You guys can both tell it if it's a different story. I don't know.
No, what happens is, Amy, a daddy improviser and another daddy improviser mm-hmm. who love each other very much mm-hmm. get together. Mm-hmm. No, it was quite simple. Actually, what happened was we did this course together, and one of the things we worked out from like the second week was that we literally live about 500 yards away from each other. And we were both having to schlep up to North London from South London. And quite often I'd be cycling up there and Alex would usually be driving because he'd be coming from work. And then some days I'd have, you know, if I'd have gone in by the tube and the train, I'd say to Alex, do you have your car with you? And that kind of, please. And he'd go, yeah. And then we'd have drive back across town and have all that extra time to, like, you know, you can sort of depressurize from the class you've been in and chit chat. And and just over the course of that time, I thought, you know what? I reckon we could do a podcast here. And I'd been coming up with an idea of doing a podcast, a sketch comedy show. And yeah, so we just kind of thought, hey, why don't we do this? And because we're go-getting can-do guys, mm-hmm. we did it. You know, it took us about, what, 6 months to get our act together?
Yeah.
But that was because I'd had a very big break, you know, like a 7 or 8 year break from sound editing. So I needed to get back up to speed on how to do it.
Oh, yeah. Technology probably just the whole changed. Thing is,
yeah, well, I mean, well, it just I hadn't done it in that long.
Mm.
I still have the same equipment I was using in 2006. You know, it's really old stuff. It's Pro Tools, though. So, I mean, it's good
for work.
Yeah. Very solid, but it is 2006 Pro Tools. Anyway, that's beside the point. But it took us 6 months to line up other performers to be in it, other people to write, you know, because it's not just us that writes the whole show. That would be too much work. And just to get that sort of collegiate feel, but with us at the tiller, you know?
Yeah.
And then we launched.
Did you launch with like multiple episodes done? Because you said you took a little time. Did you like record a bunch of stuff and get like 3 or 4 episodes done before you started?
We only had one episode fully edited, but the way we do our recordings, we do over a couple of days, which might be one whole weekend or it might be the Saturday one weekend, Sunday the next. But over those couple of days, we get everyone in. And we just record a load of sketches. I mean,
yeah.
Quite often we'll end up those 2 days with 25, 30 or more sketches.
Well, we'll do 20 in a day.
Yeah, easily.
You know, so I think our record for a day, I think, might be 27.
Yeah, and I think our record for a weekend was 40-something.
Yeah, yeah.
But what are you talking, like 9 or 10 per episode?
More like 6 or 7.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
So one of those recording sessions sets us up for quite a while, and then they're editors. So we didn't have a bunch of shows. We didn't really know much about launching a podcast, to be honest.
Hmm.
So I know some people say you should have a few shows all ready to go. We didn't do that. We went a completely different way. And originally we were doing it weekly. The first, what was it, 12 shows?
Yeah.
We were putting out one show a week. And it was just brutal. The schedule was brutal. And mostly for Nick, it was just the pressure of editing the show.
I love doing 25 hours of sound editing a week, though.
For no money, though? I mean, I'm sure you do.
Are you sure we should be doing this weekly? And you kept saying, yeah. And then in the end you said, no. Would you mind if we go to fortnightly? No, I wouldn't mind. I've been saying it all the time.
It's hard, though. You know, you look at things online that say, oh, it's got to be this. All it's got to be is regular. As long as somebody keeps getting it, even if they get it once a week or once every 2 weeks or, heck, once a month. Like, as long as they know. They're fine with it these days, but I understand putting expectations on yourself. Like, I have to do this and this must happen. Why can't I do it? And then super sorry, but it's difficult. So you got to give yourself a break. I'm glad you gave yourself the break. I was worried you'd be like, and we still do it weekly. And you know, he had a mental breakdown a couple months ago, but it's okay. And we're going to be fine. So,
well,
you know,
the thing that the original podcast I did, Whack My Bush, we were doing 3 8-minute episodes a week. So it was a 24 minutes of scripted comedy a week. And that really was brutal, because that was a minimum of, you know, pretty much I was doing 45 hours a week on that show. Jeez. On top of my normal paid work. So,
plus, was it all just about politics? Was it just, like all the sketches were about the same kind of thing?
It was really a sitcom. It was a sitcom about George Bush Jr.
W.
And Donald Rumsfeld. But we had some very good impressionists. And then we'd play with it. So we'd have Arnold Schwarzenegger was in every show. As one of George Bush's, you know, cohorts.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Rumsfeld, rather than trying to do Donald Rumsfeld's voice, we had him as Yoda.
Yeah.
Or Yoda as him.
Sure.
You know, just silly, crazy stuff. But, it was all political satire.
Yeah, Well, I was just thinking, like, that makes it even harder. Like, when you're doing comedy and you're, like, listening to stuff as you're editing it, it's not, like, the worst. Like, I like editing these episodes because I get to, like, re-listen. I take time. I'll put this away in a folder, and then in 3 weeks I'll come back to it and edit it, and I'll re-listen to it. And I'm like, oh, remember? That was nice. You know, so it's, like, a whole new experience. And with comedy, you get to enjoy that and get through it and make it sound good. But I imagine going through the politics can get a little heavy.
You know? Oh, well, it was all silly politics. I mean, none of it made it. It was, you know, things like one scenario was George Bush gets lost in Europe, and Tony Blair, who's prime minister here at the time, and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Condoleezza Rice hire Mr. T to be the fourth member of their ABBA tribute band Yabba Dabba Doo and go undercover in Europe to rescue George Bush.
Okay, so not like the hard, yeah, it's not like the hard topics, not like hard hitting.
No.
Okay, no. Cool. Guys, remember when George W. Bush was the scariest thing? Remember?
Yes, yes, those were the days.
Ah, those were the days. I'd hug him right now if I saw him. I'd hug him right in the face. Coronavirus and all. I'm sorry. I hear someone saying
something. No, you go.
You guys have talked about like developing this team that you do the sketches with, that you're working with. So you're essentially like the two main producers with a crowd of people that are developing this material with you, both writing it and performing it. What is that like? Like how many people, how does it work? You said you do it like 2 days a month. Is it like every weekend or, you know, like once a month for 2 days? Like how's the team connect?
In normal times. I guess it's about every 5 or 6 weeks, Nick.
Yeah.
We have one of these big marathon recording sessions. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, we got people we know who write, and we ask them if they've got sketches. If they've got them, they send them. If they don't, they don't. We both write as well. So, and certainly more recently, we've been carrying quite a lot of the load of writing. But we also did at one point, we did an open call for writers, which pulled in a lot of very, very, very bad stuff, but some really, really good new writers. And that was a bit of a pleasure, actually. So quite a few of those are working with us as well. And then in terms of performers, some of them were from the improv classes. Some of them were people we knew from around the circuit. And it's whoever can turn up, really.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not like the same five or six people that do it every time. It's like you cast anew with each meeting.
It depends.
We've already got like half a dozen or so who've been there pretty much all the time. And then there's other people who sometimes they can, sometimes they can't.
Yeah, it's a sort of a movable feast, a loose conglomeration, because obviously these guys, you know, the actor's life, the writer's life is difficult to predict. So we've always made it very clear to anyone who we've had in writing or acting with us, look, if you can't do it for 6 months or a year, that's fine. Come back to us when you can. Just let us know. Right. And you're always welcome, you know, because unless somebody doesn't fit with us, and so far I think that's down to literally one person, you know, we're really happy to just let people mix in. Everyone now knows.
People can only turn up for a couple of hours. That's cool as well.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, people might literally say, I can do 2 till 4. Is that all right? We're like, yes. We'll line up the sketches for when you're there.
Yeah. Perfect. I like it.
What's made it a bit more tricky is obviously lockdown. So what we've been doing, obviously, we had a big load of sketches recorded from the last big session.
Thank God.
Which has been keeping us going. And then we've been doing monologues. So we send we asked for scripts for monologues, and we produced, we wrote some as well, and we sent them out to some of the actors, or we've done some of them, and sort of fitting those into the shows as well to help make our material go a bit further.
Totally. Totally. That's great. That's a great idea. Plus, you know, hey man, exercise a new writing. You're usually writing for multiple people. Now you got to write for one. Doesn't mean it can't be just as good a sketch.
Yeah, true.
Totally. One of the things I've been teaching a sketch comedy writing class on Saturdays, and I do like a 5-week workshop situation where it's like the first 3 weeks are like just basic ideas on how to come up with sketch ideas and different ways to look at it. And then the 4th week is solo sketches, and the 5th week is multiple person sketches. And my homework for the solo sketch day is always write me a 2-page monologue, and if you can, record it and put it on the internet, because why not? You're home.
Yeah.
Get her done. Right? So that, yeah. I've been trying to, like, do that, you know, just to, a lot of people were looking for something creative because there aren't classes happening right now and nothing's going on. So I've worked with a couple of different, like, troops that'll come to me and be like, we all want to take it together. And then that way they can take what I've told them and work on their own thing together separately. But yeah, you know, solo sketches are really great. I love the fact that you're like getting them from people and like trying a new different thing. I feel like the nice thing about having to adjust the way that we perform with the lockdown has really opened up a lot of creative solutions for a lot of people. And I find that great. I feel like a lot of things had been stagnant in, you know, sort of creative things. Okay, I guess this is how we do it. Awesome. So now that have to reinvent a little bit, I think that that's helped. That's really, like, you know, got people's imaginations going. I'm trying to look on the bright side, you know.
No, I think absolutely. It's been really interesting how people have coped. Because part of my day job is I direct voiceovers.
Nice.
For short animations. And, you know, normally I'd go to a recording studio, sit with the engineer, have the vocal artist in the booth, maybe have the client with us or at the end of a phone and all of this. And what we've been doing is literally it's the voice artist at home with their computer and their microphone. Then the engineer is at his house or her house. I'm at my house. We're all doing it over Zoom. It's crazy, but it's really worked, you know. So it is fascinating how people are coping.
Yeah, sort of reinventing how they accomplish the task. Like, that's awesome. I'm so glad that works out for you.
Yeah, well, thankfully, one of those voiceover artists is one of our performers, so he has a really sweet setup at home. So when he's doing stuff, it actually sounds better than the stuff we record in our booth at my house, which is where we normally record. So
in the future, we're just going to his house. That's the plan.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Cool. I think that would be the way to do it.
Seems right.
All round to Casper's.
Uh-oh. Please, everyone, don't rush his house right now. Put your masks on. Stay away. Yell from the window. Yeah. We wish we could come in. Your microphone is beautiful.
Oh no, we can do that now. The lockdown's almost finished here, you know. And if you're a member of the government, the lockdown was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen in the world. I'm not going to pretend to know. But what I would love to hear from you guys, sort of as a final question to wrap it up, is you've told a lot of great stories, a lot of different experiences that you guys have had along the way. Do either one of you or both of you have any advice for people who would potentially be, you know, like you were when you just met, you know, or in various creative things? How do you keep it going when things don't work out, or how do you find somebody? Like, what do you need to be open to get the work done, or find somebody to do the work with? Any advice you have?
Alex, do you have any thoughts?
Work with people you get on with. Don't work with idiots. don't work with people who annoy you or who want to do what they want to do and don't really care about what you want to do. You have to have that relationship where actually you're both enjoying what you're doing, or you're all enjoying what you're doing. And I think that's the main thing, actually. Just enjoy it. Do something you enjoy doing. And if you don't enjoy doing it, don't do it.
Hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. Especially, I mean, you know, because doing things that when you've got a podcast, you know, there are times it's not easy. You know, if you're looking at your numbers, you're not happy with the number of listeners you've got, and you're trying to work out how to get the word out about your wonderful podcast. And it can be, it's not necessarily all fun. Or even if, you know, sometimes I'll be doing editing a show and it's not going according to plan, and one sketch has taken me 6 or 7 hours and I'm wanting to tear my hair out. You know, you need to be working with people that you get on with in those situations, because otherwise you very rapidly fall apart, you know. And I think it's mutual respect as well. It's like a marriage. As soon as the respect goes out of the marriage, then the marriage is really doomed, I'd say. You've got to like the person and respect them as a person. Or have you stopped respecting me, Alex?
Good creative advice and marriage advice. Guys, you're really doing it.
Of course I respect you, Nick.
Oh, that's good. Because I know that you like to write around with other creative partners.
No, it's just you, Nick.
Yeah,
it's
just you. Oh, if only that were true. No.
He uses protection when he writes with them.
Oh, thank goodness.
It's okay. Won't affect you. Oh, guys, thank you for being on the podcast and chatting with me. I really appreciate you sharing stories of your life and being so open about everything. You guys are really fun. I also loved all the riffing. That was really enjoyable. And I'm excited for all of your future episodes and collaborations.
Oh, thanks, Amy. It's been brilliant.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.